Welcome to Overexpressed and Out. I'm Jenny Burkholder.
And I'm Roseanne Liberti. This episode of Overexpressed and Out features four advocates working tirelessly for disability rights and cultural access here in the Philadelphia area.
That's right, Roseanne. Today we feature Lisa Sonnenborn, Katie Sampson, Shannon Brooks, and Victoria McGuigan. We're thrilled to have them together in the same room.
Lisa Sonnenborn, she, her, is the Director of Media Arts and Culture for the Institute on Disabilities located within Temple University's College of Education and Human Development. Her work has engaged communities locally, nationally, and internationally in conversations around the lived experience of disability, the preservation of disability history, and cultural access.
Katie Sampson, she, her, is an educator, disability advocate, and storyteller who actively engages in Philadelphia arts and culture. She is the Community and Programs Director for the West Collection.
Shannon Brooks, they, she, is a multisensory, multimedia artist grounded in iterative, time-based experimentation. Shannon is a founder of Hook and Loop, a collective of disabled artists, and Undue Burden, a digital community archive led by disabled people in Philadelphia.
Victoria McGuigan, she, her, is a performing arts educator, dancer, choreographer, and presenter. She is the founder and director of the Autism Bridge Initiative, which provides dance and dance theater workshops for children and youth on the topic of neurodiversity, conducts adapted dance courses for the disabilities community, and presents trainings on the topic of sensory accessibility to assist educators and other professionals. Welcome to Overexpressed and Out. I'm Jenny Burkholder.
And I'm Roseanne Liberti.
It is an honor and pleasure to be here today in Wincote, Pennsylvania, sharing the space with four amazing humans active here in Philadelphia in cultural access and disability rights. I think we're going to start, Roseanne, by sharing our joys. Lisa, how about you? What is your joy this morning?
Honestly, I think my joy is being in a room with all of you wonderful people. Sometimes people I get to collaborate with, always people I admire. And just a thrill to be here.
Let's see. My joy today, this is Katie, is yesterday I made soup. And usually I'm pretty good about following a recipe. But yesterday I decided to go rogue and... It's probably like the best soup I've ever made. And it's just kind of waiting for me when I get home because I had a little yesterday, but I know it's just going to get better and better. And yeah, I'm excited. It's soup season, y'all.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My joy today, this is Shannon speaking, is I'm really enjoying my heating pad. You know, it's heating pad season as much as it is soup season. And by that, I mean, I have this theory that I wake up and my neck is thrown out around this time every year. And it's funny because I was wondering like a few weeks ago, like, oh, I'm not using my heating pad like I usually do. I wonder why. And it's funny. It's like I forget this happens every year. So my joy is having this support, but maybe something that's more outwardly joyful. I don't have like scheduled work after this, so I can be in my home and just be doing the work I want to be doing. Maybe do a little experimenting myself, make a soup, maybe. Mm-hmm. If I get out of bed. But yes, that's my joy.
This is Victoria, and my joy today, it's so interesting. I have a pot of organic chicken soup that is, as we speak, in the crock pot, stewing. The lights are on the tree. Mm-hmm. The ornaments are finished, but for three. We call it the memory tree because each year we get ornaments to put on that represents the year we've had. And it's chock full. And my joy is in the lighting. I just love the play of lights from the tree and the mantle and the branches. This time of year, the bare branches that dance on the on the walls when the sun streams through the house. It's just, I love lighting, so that's my joy today.
Beautiful. So, Lisa, can you tell us, what is the work that you do in the world? What is your outward expression?
So I direct media arts and culture programming for the Institute on Disabilities, which is a center at Temple University, seated in the College of Education. And what that means is we look to our community being people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families, to think about what are the persistent issues in our community? What are the questions that people are asking? And how can we find our way into those questions through arts-based methodologies? So what I love about what I do is that it changes with the question that we're trying to answer. And I'm never, ever an expert in what I do, because I'm always working in a way that's new or different, and I have to learn along with my collaborators.
Okay.
Yeah, so I wear a lot of hats. It's been very hard to separate the volunteer work that I do, the advocacy, being a community organizer, with the quote unquote job, so to speak, but I'm an educator and trainer with CHACS Training and Consulting. I also have my own independent consulting practice where I do a lot of advising on accessibility in the built environment as well as in the digital space, and program adaptation, inclusive design. And then I also work with a lot of clinical researchers predominantly focused in spinal cord injury. And as opposed to what Lisa said, I like to say I am an expert in my own lived experience as a disabled person. And so I think I bring a lot of that into cultural communities, at various sectors, to better inform people on access practices.
I am an artist. I'm a facilitator of space and time, meaning I put on some events or long-term projects. I teach or facilitate movement or dance classes or different art. I'm a multimedia artist, so I really have like an idea or a thought or a question, and I use whatever materials or practices or experiments. Soup, making soup could be, you know, an experiment. whatever I need to do in order to explore this question or idea. And because of my lived experience as a chronically ill and I'm visually impaired person, and, you know, we won't even talk about mental health. But, you know, because of my personal experiences with all of this, I bring a lot of access into my art, and I also collaborate with a lot of disabled people. I've worked in a lot of different jobs in the job world as like employment support or a dance teacher at, you know, terrifying sheltered workshops or other places in Philly, and I've really like found my people and wonderful friends and artist collaborators, and through all of this relation, through this and through like the DIY punk weirdo world of Philly, I've been able to be a part of creating a really cool collective of disabled artists called, we call ourselves Hook and Loop. And anyone can be involved, anyone here, you're all involved, great. but we put on events together, we hang out, and we're just a group of artists or creative leaning people who wanna hang out and make things happen. And because of who we are, it tends to be more accessible.
Victoria?
I am a dance and dance theater artist, educator, choreographer. I am also the director of the Autism Bridge Initiative, a for-profit business that utilizes dance and dance theater as vehicles through which to teach populations about neurodiversity and disabilities in general. I work with children and youth populations as well as adult populations within the disabilities community and also neurotypical individuals to give them entree into our world, the world of disabilities, and how to facilitate inclusion. That inclusion is not simply to be facilitated by the professionals, but that each of us can facilitate inclusion. I work with children as young as 3 and 4 years old, and throughout the lifespan, working with schools, universities, community organizations, and neighborhoods, just going in and giving talks to communities about our neurodiverse population. I also have developed a sensory processing disorder presentation and training, which helps educators and staff members within schools, within other community environments, to learn about accessibility in terms of sensory needs of our population, which are oftentimes pronounced and unaddressed because sensory processing disorder is not a physical disorder in which others identify that you're struggling necessarily, or they misinterpret that communication as something else. So I work in those ways within the population and have taught at Temple University for many years in a program I founded for children and youth. Left that to do all of this work.
Thank you. I want to take a minute to thank Lisa for bringing us all together into this room, for helping us to be collaborative in this way. I mean, this is our future, is being in rooms together, collaborating, hearing from each other, listening to each other, being able to ask questions of each other. And Over Expressed and Out, our podcast, really takes this very seriously, especially now in 2025, in this historical moment, about amplifying the voices, your voices, so that, you know, other people are aware, and that, you know, that we can facilitate more discussion about inclusion or more discussion about, you know, sensory processing, whatever, all of those ways. So thank you, Lisa, for bringing us here into this room. And again, thank you all for making time and space for actually being here to share who you are and what it is you do. And Roseanne?
Yes, Jenny. Thank you for saying all that. Yeah, this is where it gets exciting now, I think. I mean, it's all exciting, but there's something very special when you ask people, how did you get to where you are? How did you get to this place and doing this work? Start with you.
About 10 years ago, my background is in documentary filmmaking. So about 10 years ago, the executive director of the Institute on Disabilities invited me to do an oral history project called Visionary Voices, which was meant to capture the stories of Pennsylvania's disability rights movement. Many of those stories were being lost because people were getting older and their stories were leaving this earth with them. So in doing that work over a couple of years, I realized what an incredibly rich history we have, not only in the country, but in Philadelphia specifically, in Pennsylvania specifically. We really are a city and state of many firsts, many milestones in the disability community. But those stories were staying in our community. They weren't reaching others, and that just didn't seem right. So in thinking about how to bring those stories to a broader audience, we thought about creating a play. and things just kind of steamrolled. We wanted to do a play, which we did, called A Fierce Kind of Love, written by Suli Holm. But the play was cast, really co-developed, in partnership with actors with and without disabilities who were telling stories in ways that were accessible to them. And in doing that, we realized that we were just at the beginning of understanding what cultural access might mean to our community. I was thinking about how to bring the stories of our community to more people, and bringing our stories to more people means really deeply considering what accessibility means, who's telling the stories, and how they'll be told.
Yeah, I think I started out my career, so to speak, as a camp counselor in high school, teaching drama and like creative performance to little ones, and then became a drama specialist. And I realized that there was something really that I loved about theater and improv. And when I look back on that training as improv and performance, it really set me up for so many ways that I could kind of bend and twist at any like problem that would come my way or any conflict. And my mom was a school teacher and my dad was an attorney, and he said I was terrible with conflict, and so I shouldn't be a lawyer. Not terrible, but I shouldn't be a lawyer. Little did he know that I would get into disability advocacy, you know, many years later. So I was started out that journey of like, I'm going to do something really different than, and that became doing museum education. I did my graduate degree in art history, and I thought I was going to teach and work in art museums. And I started having these really interesting encounters with either individuals or school groups or accessible audiences in which I would have to bend and twist or adapt something that we were learning because there were access needs or requirements that needed to happen within the gallery space or a certain program. And this was very early, like 2000s, when there were some museums doing this type of practice for very outwardly and openly, but not in a very collective manner. And I realized that not only it was the work that really excited me, but I could also tap into a lot of my creative juices, so to speak. And then an opportunity came about to move back to the Philadelphia region because I'd previously been living in the Southwest. And I started working with a group of veterans who had returned from Iraq and Afghanistan that were on the GI Bill. And it was an incredible opportunity to talk about their lived experience, not from a place of kind of trauma porn, but to really address the ways in which they could learn from museum objects, engage with them, but also sort of find a sense of peace and self and reflect on those moments in a historical process. And that's when I think a light bulb went off for me that I had to deeply connect more with the work of finding audiences to engage with that, for the most part, had never really stepped foot into a cultural institution. And so I really liked that idea of trying to lasso people into this world that maybe had never had that moment in their life before. And so I think I started embedding access practices around that time as a museum educator, and then decided in my own experience and in my own life as a disabled person, I started rounding the corner of saying, reaching a point of acceptance that I couldn't ignore the fact that I was a wheelchair user, that I was hard of hearing, that there were certain elements of my own experience that I needed to talk about and could also inform other people's work as well. So there was sort of a merging of those two sides that came together, I'd say about 12 years ago. And ever since then, it's been a way that I can tap into both. And I think I can't really ever turn it off. So it's there to stay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's hard to say for me too, because yeah, lots of experiences have led me to be who I am. I think I lived my childhood, you know, I've always been an artist and making things, and I grew up being a dancer and always in pain and chronically ill and dealing with that, but not really, you know, dealing with it or getting the resources to properly like support myself. But and then, you know, I'm a weirdo in the art world growing up and going to school. And then it was actually during college where I injured my eye while working at a retail store. And I think it's really through the, of course, like being, I'm blind in one of my eyes. And so of course, that experience is very, you know, it's a life changing. But the bigger part that pissed me off more and made me think a lot more about like what is disability was the settlement that I had to go through with the company because of the way that disability was like summed up. Had nothing to do with my experience in my body, mind, and space time, but it had to do with how much money I was going to be able to make, which I think a lot of disability is about. You know, if you learn more about SSI or SSDI, it's actually about how much profit we can make someone. So it has nothing to do with who we are. And then that I said, show me an abled person. I think an abled person might actually be like a capitalist thought, like idea, you know, just to keep us moving, keeping us working with our heads down. And then after school, I feel like there's this big wave of, you know, just weird art kids working at different, like, you know, there's different programs, day programs, employment support places that support artists with various disabilities. And through that experience, I was a dance teacher there. I would like throw like raucous dance parties in the middle of the scheduled art program. But so we brought the dance party upstairs, downstairs, and we would just this like little group started forming of like, we would just throw these really cool dance parties. Or, you know, if it was really nice, we'd be like, let's make it like a block party outside. Well, like, just let's go outside, you know, get out of the warehouse. And then the pandemic hit, the lockdown happened, and we started meeting online. We were like, let's keep the party going. And we got out like literally of this warehouse area. And like, meanwhile, I'm having conversations with like all of my other artist friends we all are chronically ill and disabled this whole time. And I'm starting to read more about disability justice and the history of that and getting connected to all of those amazing artists and movers and creators, and just like blue, this like flower, just like, or I don't know, maybe more like a volcano going off, like finding my people, finding family, finding, you know, yeah, when you find your people. And yeah, so through that we started meeting online. We were like, oh, we're a crew now, we're a collective. And we've put together some really cool like variety shows online, and then we started meeting in person. We were like, let's just bring a hoagie to Clark Park, you know, we'll hang out. So we'll do some performances. And it's really this awesome collaboration between folks in the DIY scene in this world where it's like, we'll put on a show in the basement. It's like, you know, the art gallery, we don't need that. We can do it in our backyard. With also the like, okay, well, we need, in order to do that, we're going to have to build a ramp. And it's like, okay, well, let's call, you know, let's go to the West Philly Tool Library, see what they can do. Or, you know, just kind of like using this scrappiness to get together. And one really cool project we've done together is something called Undue Burden, which is this digital archive. I feel like everyone has a museum. I met one of my good friends, Pam Price. She's an artist born and raised Philly. She's in her 60s and lived She just is an amazing painter, poet, and she also collected so much of her life, like through pictures and just newspaper clippings, and has been through a lot of like bullshit too. So like, you know, living as a person and a disabled person, like, you know, and she's just kept this archive and put it all over her walls. And through hanging out with her, I was like, we should make an art, like we should document this, like let's make a digital museum. Like everyone's got their own museum. I'm sure we all do. We started creating this digital archive that very imperfectly allows disabled people, or invites disabled people, to document their history how they want to, instead of it being, you know, documented by doctors or in case notes from your, you know, direct support person, or yeah. So that's how I got to the work. Personal experience and finding friends. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Getting a lot of anger and love. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the love and the rage.
Yes.
Please, yes. Step in.
May I say something? Just this idea of archiving a life, anyone's life, of course, is important. But Shannon, when you're talking about that, I'm thinking about work that we've done in institutional settings where people have no photographs, no evidence of the lives they lived before they went to institutions, and really during the time that they've been living in institutions. And we've done projects that have brought photography into those settings, and often they're the first photographs that people have ever had. So I really just wanted to say how important I thought that work, I still think that work is that you're doing. I think Undue Burden is a real treasure.
Victoria, how did you find your way into the work that you do?
So my journey to now began, I think, from the time I was very, very little. I was raised by a single dad who was also a professional vocalist and drummer. We're often on the road with Dad. I often say I grew up at the bass drum. And probably have been performing longer than I remember, because we would be at a gig, because Dad didn't have caregivers for us, my brother and I, and we'd be called up on stage to play the bongos or sing a song in the microphone or, you know, dance with the band. I quickly became in love, just fell in love with the art of movement, with dance, and danced from the time I was very young. Thereafter, pursuing dance became my focus, but a rather meandering path paid my way through college in law firms, working in Philadelphia law firms, and which later became very, very advantageous to me as an advocate. Didn't realize at the time it was simply a means to an end to get my dance degree. And after graduating, I received my degree from Temple University. I was invited into a dance company at the time, Anne Vachon Dance Conduit. I had studied with Anne within Temple's dance department. And our work was both performance-oriented in the community with choreography, you know, full choreographic performances, as well as Anne's commitment to dance education for children and youth elicited grants to bring the company into local schools to do residencies. And within these residency programs, I was already an educator myself for children and youth. But in these residency programs, we were brought into classrooms that were at the time inclusive, mm-hmm. as inclusive was defined or not at that time. And we were able to, or I was able for the first time, to work with children who were not hearing or were visually impaired. It was not identified for us any other types of disabilities, but my wheel started turning, and I just remember like going into my toolbox of dance and dance education strategies to work with some of these individuals, like, you know,
putting their hands on my shoulders while I clapped out the rhythm we were going to pursue, to dance a phrase across the floor, mm-hmm. you know, holding a hand and doing the movement so they felt the rise and fall of a particular sequence and just how much was available to us as dance educators that was not taught to me per se, but began to develop and emerge from these experiences. Now, having said that, I grew up with disabilities under my own roof. My great uncle lived with us. He was there for like my grandfather's age and sort of a pseudo granddad. And he had one eye because he lost an eye in the steel mill where he worked as a young adult. And
literally been there.
Yeah. And he had a
not steel mill, but
yes. Yes. So, you know, my brother and I grew up with Uncle John having a glass eye, which he often lost around the house. And I also had a great aunt on my maternal side of the family who was born with difficulties in childbirth, led to her having brain damage, broken jaw, and then later many, many disabilities. And my great-grandmother cared for her, chose not to institutionalize her, and cared for her until she was 83 years old. Mm. And my great-grandmother was 103. And they were in the same nursing home together, inevitably. But that experience growing up with these elders with disabilities, whom I just accepted as part of the clan because that's who they were. So I think that foundationally is where my journey began with the disabilities community. And I would not have necessarily elicited that until I myself became a parent of a disabled child and realized how many tools I already had in my toolbox for working, not just in engaging with him, but in advocating for him. And my boy was diagnosed at 21 months of age with autism, sensory processing disorder as well, and is nonverbal. So there began, not my journey with disabilities, because I realized I already had layered into the whole of my experience these understandings of the disabilities community, which I would not have even labeled as such at the time, because these were loved ones and just part of my community. Mm-hmm. And however, I became aware of, unfortunately, the discrimination, the lack of resources, and so many other roadblocks as a parent who was advocating for and supporting an individual with disabilities. And thus began the Autism Bridge Initiative, which is my present company that supports the creative process for individuals with disabilities as well as neurotypical individuals in four programs, and then in dance and dance theater, and then also a program for educators and facilitators and parents in understanding sensory processing disorder, which is also one of the key diagnoses for individuals with autism. And in understanding how to create sensory accessible environments, sensory accessible homes, classrooms, community groups, and bringing to our population all of that scaffolding that enables them to be fully immersed in society. And the dance program, the dance programming is really, is just really such, it's like my second baby, because it
teaches not only the individual whom with a disability or perhaps with several disabilities, any number of disabilities, how to access dance and dance composition or choreography, but through a course that I call Dancing Our Differences, I work with neurotypical populations of children, youth, and adults to teach them about neurodiversity and how to become equipped in accepting and communicating with our population.
Wow. Wow. This is a mighty group.
There is something incredibly interesting about the time we're in right now and celebrating the semi-quincentennial of Philadelphia and the and Declaration of Independence, that like in the 18th century in Philadelphia, like everyone had a disability. You know, you were walking around like your shopkeeper, your family member, like it wasn't really talked about. It was just like part of society. It's like, we got to go back there. I mean, like, this is a moment where we need to be talking about the fact that, because as you were saying these things about your family members, it's just like part of your growing up and like your childhood. And it's similar for me and in that way. And I think because of institutionalization, because of HIPAA, because of so many things, we just, we keep it so quiet and behind doors. And, you know, when the disability rights movement, I think, started to see that shift, it was like, oh, we can... there's now a place where we can talk about it and be outward about it. And yet like Philadelphia is such a great way to root ourselves in that kind of deep history, you know?
Sure.
I grew up in Philadelphia and our proximity to Pennhurst meant that I didn't have a meaningful relationship with anyone with a disability when I was growing up because our communities had been largely emptied of our people with disabilities and or of our disability community. Or people were supporting their family member at home without any other external support, so they tended not to be out and about as much. So we do have a very interesting history in Philadelphia, for sure. Yeah.
I'm thinking about Shannon, I believe it was you, who said it's about being in charge of your story, right? And when I think of access and cultural access, I see it from two places, right? It's the access to seeing the arts and to being, you know, a participant and a consumer, and as well as this access to being an artist, right? And so I wonder, for all of you, what does access mean?
Good question.
I'll start. This is Katie. I think so often in disability justice spaces, we talk about forced intimacy and this idea that you are constantly in public places having to disclose your disability for whatever reason. And, you know, I liken it to when you go to the post office and you mail a package, they don't really ask you what the contents are inside the package. You just like slap a label on it and it's good to go. And yet we walk into a door and if you need to relieve yourself in some way, you have to disclose like, where is your restroom? Or, you know, and can you point in that direction? And there's this ability, I think, with cultural access where a fluidity of someone's personhood can come, go, experience, engage, rage, you know, have feelings outwardly expressed, inwardly expressed, and that their needs are being met, but in a way that's not so prescribed, I think. And in at the same time, I have a lot of contradictory things that go on because I believe that disabled people also have the right to have those access needs amplified because they've been disregarded for so much of time. And so there's a push-pull, I feel like, in this idea of forced intimacy or forced disclosure, but then also like I am proud of who I am and I deserve to be here and I want to claim that for myself and for my people in a way. So I think there is a tension always in access for me personally, and I think for a lot of people in the community. And so it's ever twisting and bending in my mind, that definition.
And this is Lisa. I mean, to your point, Katie, the points you're making, I think of what happens in our cultural spaces, yeah? We gather in community with others. We see our lives reflected back to us, or we learn about the lives of people we wouldn't ordinarily get to meet. So we have these conversations in these spaces that shape our worldview, and yet we're also comfortable, sort of, as a cultural sector, saying not everyone gets to access those spaces because you don't communicate in a traditional way, or we can't quite give you the access you need today, so sorry. This is really, I think, what access means to me is justice, you know, fairness at its most basic level, but social justice is really, I think, what we're talking about. I mean, what other group of people would we say, I'm really sorry, we can't accommodate you today, you can't come here.
Done that plenty of times. Yeah, it happens over and over again.
We've done that plenty of times historically, but I'm thinking now in 2025, I mean, really, which groups are we comfortable saying that to? And as someone who works primarily in the intellectual and developmental disabilities community, I feel that community is less often invited to the table, either as audience members or as art makers. When there's plenty of talent and interest in that community.
Yeah, to be able to like ask that question that blatantly is like really putting it on it. Like, this is what we're doing. Are we willing to continue doing this? Or like, how can we imagine ourselves out of this?
Even the idea of inclusion, I have to say, it's a word that I feel really troubled by. It feels very paternalistic. I mean, who is doing the inviting? Who's doing the including? I mean, I think we all use it sometimes because it's the word that people... It's a word that people is familiar to people. I'll say that again. We use the word inclusion a lot because it's a word that's familiar to people, but it doesn't feel like the right word to me.
And this is Victoria. I'm thinking about access even in that which is within the dance community. Oftentimes, a struggle because in dance, we're looking for a floor that's either sprung or is not on the first floor. Because if it's on the first floor, typically it's laid on the foundation, making it less resilient. And so then it needs to, you know, a lot more money and time and effort and energy must go into springing the floor. Whereas I'm thinking about the old group motion down on South Street, for anyone who remembers back in the day, you know, it was on the second and third floors of the building, causing there to be a little bit more opportunity for airspace between, you know, the subfloor and the flooring. Therefore, we can dance without injuring ourselves. And however, there is a 2- and 3-flight walk up to these old Philadelphia buildings in Old City, right? So, you know, thinking about our particular infrastructure in a city as old as our own, and where much of the arts buzz is happening, right, in the dance community, especially, we must think differently about where we position ourselves.
This is Lisa, and I think really what this is pointing to is the idea of cultural access is beginning from the very earliest stages of project or art ideation.
Yes.
And so it's very hard to retrofit a piece of work and really invite a community in a truly accessible, welcoming way. But if your community is part of the imagining of the work. Mm-hmm. If we're working together and really engaged in deep listening with the people who we want to engage in the work, then all kinds of things are possible, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes. For me, access, and this is not my idea, I believe this is an idea, someone definitely a mover shaker of disability justice, if I had to name someone, Alice Wong, but lovely Alice Wong. But access is a practice. It's like, mm-hmm. yeah, it's just this thing that's ever transforming and this thing that's really imperfect, and there's conflicts. It's unfortunately very expensive often, and falls. Yeah, it's just like this funny, there's so many barriers to being accessible, or you know, with big quotes, capital A, accessible. Mm-hmm. And so, and people really want it to be a checklist. Okay, how can I get everyone good? But there is no checklist, and someone else's access needs are going to mess up someone else's access needs. And so it's just like really imperfect. And I found that that mountain is like, everyone's like, well, then we won't try anything. Mm. Because it's whatever. We'll just do what we can, and or whatever the budget allows, and which is usually like nothing really, I don't know. And sorry, my pants are kind of loud. I'm gonna cross my legs and finish the sentence. But yeah, so I think I wrote access is it's like this deep listening, which is another thing I like to practice. It's mm-hmm. Pauline Oliveros, deep listening. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, that, you know, I've learned deep listening as from a dance practice and meditation sound practice, where you're like literally just listening to sounds big and small, far and close. But I like to expand that to like my skin and to kind of this like more metaphorical idea of listening to people with what they actually need. Making mistakes, being like, ooh, I asked that question wrong, and then laughing about it together and being like, oh, I messed up.
This is Lisa. I keep thinking too about the imperfection of access, which is part of what makes it also a beautiful practice, in that you kind of have to be humble to the practice. Mm. You have to be constantly engaged with your community, right, or with the people who are in your cultural space, to make sure it's working and to figure out what you need to tweak or how you need to be nimble in order to make something work. But I think I don't think the fact that it's challenging should be reason not to try. And I think where people make a mistake very often when they try to make their event accessible, their cultural event accessible, their cultural space accessible, I think the mistake that people often make is that they don't pair the access with the community engagement. Mm. So someone will say, well, I booked the ASL interpreter, but nobody came. Yeah. And then we'll say, okay, so what kind of outreach or engagement did you do with the deaf community? And like, I'm not sure we did that.
Yeah.
So the engagement is really, I think, where the magic happens. If you are talking to people, trying to build trust, because I think that inviting people into your space requires a lot of trust, particularly if you're someone with a disability and it's not easy to get to your cultural mm-hmm. space. You maybe have to deal with getting ready to leave your home and then struggling with powered transit or public transportation and coming to an event space that maybe isn't as accessible as they advertised in on the website or in their promotional materials. It's all a lot of trust, and if you have to work really hard to be worthy of that trust for when people come and engage with you.
Lisa, at the beginning you talked about this idea about living in the question. You know, like the, and the questions change as we change, as access changes, as our interests change, all of those things change. So I'm curious at this point if you and any of you are cognizant at this point about the question that you're living in. Like, what is at the forefront of your, I don't know, consciousness right now in terms of what you're asking.
Okay, Victoria, dive in. Thank you.
So the question that I continue to ask myself is, you know, as a parent of an individual with multiple disabilities, I've been taught societally to ask, how can I help my child to understand and therefore better navigate the world? And what I've learned as a disabilities advocate, as well as a parent and artist for the disabled, is that I need to prepare society to ask that question of themselves. So that there's an interplay, like there's a duet, right? There's a dance to happen here, and it is not one-sided. It is not that our individuals need to find inroads. We need to prepare for them in a way that is fully accepting.
I'm really encouraged, right, by the younger generation of artists and the people who will be arts administrators, young emerging artists, younger established artists. I think they get it. You know, they get why access is important. They recognize the need for it in their lives. And I mean access writ large. Mm-hmm. It's not just about access for people with disabilities. It's about ticket costs and really whatever it is that that makes you feel welcome or able to access a cultural space. So one of the things I'm thinking about is how we bring ACTUS practices to younger artists and to the people who will be the next generation of arts administrators. I mean, we can keep knocking on the door systemically, saying to people, please consider this in your institution, please consider this for your organization, or we can change it from within. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking a lot about how we engage young people, young emerging artists, in access practices, in the principles of disability justice, so that when they're part of the system is already kind of stacked in our favor. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that I'm most hopeful for is this idea that we've started to recognize that access to nature, access to creative practice, it encourages wellness practice, and it's healthy, right? It is a prescription that can be put down on a notepad by a physician in certain countries now, and actually like prescribed. Social prescribing is a thing that's a movement that's taken hold in the UK and in Canada, and it's something that I'm really interested in. I think Philadelphia is ripe for social prescribing in so many areas.
The question I'm exploring, well, I think in art spaces and creative spaces, we get to imagine things that we're like maybe not allowed to imagine, or that seem impossible. And especially in accessibility, you know, it's like, what do you, you know, there's so many times where, what we're dreaming is told to be impossible, but that is not the truth, or that, you know, we find a way through it through collaboration, and through like deep listening and through transforming like our material conditions. And so I think the arts can be a really great space to say, you know, the quiet parts out loud, to have people who don't get the resources to have a space to talk about what it would be like to have the resources or maybe get resources. But to say the quiet part out loud, I think like, what I dream of is, like, in order to make, like, a lot of the things that we're saying reality, we would need a different, like, we would not need a for-profit healthcare system. We need free healthcare.
I think we're ready for some truths. Let's change up the order.
Okay, a
I'm going to channel my paternal grandmother now. So a principle I believe is ingrained, enmeshed, embodied in me comes from my grandmother and her mothering, which is never give up. Never give up.
This is Shannon. My truth is to always allow for transformation. I always, million thoughts going through my mind. Whether that's like, in your body literally transforming, your spirit and transforming, you made a mistake and you're like, okay, now I'm going to transform. Or like, we want to transform this building to have an elevator, or we're going to transform our economic systems to allow us to have free freaking healthcare. And then who knows what will happen if we're like able to care for ourselves. I don't even know. I truly feel like a mind shift would happen.
This is Katie. I will say I think I learned this probably at 3 or 4 years old, and it's really stuck through me throughout my life, which is what Big Bird said, is you have to be a friend to have friends. And I think when I had my spinal cord injury when I was 20 years old, and at that time when, you know, I was a sophomore in college, you're supposed to be making new friends, finding your identity, being away from your parents, all the things that, you know, were sort of culturally at that time the norm for who I was supposed to be. And it took some time to connect with mentors that had sort of like-minded ways of doing things. And the spinal cord injury community is a bit different from other disabled communities in the sense that most people come into their disability later in life. They're not born with their disability. And so there's a lot of transition that has to happen where you're meeting peers, you're making new friends, you're trying to change your friends that knew you from your able-bodied life to your disabled life. And oftentimes that can be really isolating. And there were moments where I felt like people weren't reaching out, or I was not feeling like I was connecting with the friends that I had before. And it was just sort of like, well, call the people that you want to hang out with and hang out with them, or like make the thing that you want to do and ask people to join you in doing it.
This is Lisa. I think a guiding principle for me is simply to listen. I don't think I was always great at that. And I think listening is a practice that evolves. I hope I'm becoming better at it. That's always a goal. Also to do work that changes you, to let yourself be changed by the work that you do. And I think maybe the listening and the change go hand in hand. And then I think finally, I'm thinking right now about my father, who passed away this time last year at the age of 92. And he was always curious. He always questioned what he knew. He was willing to learn something else. I think it kept him really young. Mm-hmm. He was a very young 92-year-old man. Mm-hmm. Another guiding principle for sure is to always stay curious. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to learn.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot today. Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. I feel as if being in the presence of you
and being here together has been transformative for me, so I am deeply grateful for that. Well, Roseanne, this has been a pleasure. Thank you again, everyone. We're Overexpressed and out. Overexpressed and Out is engineered and produced by Roseanne Liberti and Jenny Burkholder. Thanks to Raji Malik for our theme song, Rejoice No Crisis. If you enjoyed this interview, find this and others on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And as always, tell a friend.